Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Kishore Mahabubani, who is Dean of the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy and in Singapore. For more than 30 years, he was a distinguished civil servant and diplomat for his country, serving as ambassador to Cambodia, the United States, and the United Nations. He also served as president of the Security Council. He was a permanent secretary of the foreign ministry from 93 to 98, and he was the first dean of the Civil Service College in Singapore. His most recent books are Can Asians Think? And most recently, Beyond the Age of Innocence. Mr. Mahabubani, welcome to Berkeley.
Happy to be here.
Where were you born and raised?
I was born in Singapore in 1948. It was then a British colony, and it was then a typical poor developing country, and my family came from fairly modest circumstances. So I from childhood, I experienced what it was like to live in a developing country because at the age of six, when I went to my school for the first time, they weighed me and discovered that I was undernourished, so I was put on a special feeding program. And I mentioned that because that gave me an insight into how the majority of the world live, even today.
And looking back, how do you think your parents shaped your thinking about the world?
Well, to be honest, I had a relatively difficult childhood. My dad was in and out of jobs. He, as I mentioned in the book, he even went to jail for a while because of his gambling debts. So from my father, I guess, I got to some extent a negative example of what not to do, how not to drink and gamble and smoke when you grow up. And even though, by the way, at the end, we became close to each other. And through my mother, I discovered the virtues of strength, because she obviously went through hell, being a single mother of four young children. We were living often on $50 a month for five of us. That was tough, but the fact that she never broke down under all the stress meant that I decided at a very young age that no matter what happens, I cannot break down, because she set a very high standard.
And she had really survived the trauma of the breakup of India, and she and your father had emigrated to Singapore.
Yeah, my father actually came out earlier, but my mother had a very close shave, because she actually came out as the partition was taking place, and she was leaving one night in a train across the desert, and she was in the last compartment. The last compartment got decoupled from the rest of the train. So you had this maybe about 50 to 100 Hindu women by themselves with one old Sikh guard with a single shot rifle protecting all of them. And if they had been caught by, I guess, a marauding band of then young Pakistani militants, they would all have been raped and slaughtered. But fortunately, the next day, the next train came along and pushed them along to the train station, so she survived it. So, but you know, when you hear stories like that, you understand how precarious life is and how you got to value what you have.
I get the sense then from what you're saying and reading your book that you were privileged in a sense to see, to learn about diversity and to learn about inequality, as you just said, and that in a way this process opened your horizons in an important way.
Yeah, I think people who have grown up in middle class homes have no idea of the depth of despair that poverty creates. I mean, the sense of hopelessness can be debilitating. It can damage your soul and corrupt it almost absolutely. So having, in a sense, experienced that, I can, as I say, empathize a bit with the 1 billion poor people in the world, because I've lived through, maybe my conditions were not as desperate as theirs, but they were quite tough. in their own way. And Singapore then was as a typical developing country. You had racial riots. My neighbor came home with bloodstains on his clothes because he was caught accidentally in a racial riot. I would see gangs fighting each other with beer bottles, broken beer bottles, and so you could see gushing wounds with blood and so on and so forth. So having experienced all that, when you finally reach a situation where there's peace and order and stability, you realize that these are not natural conditions, that it takes a lot of effort to achieve them, and if you have them, appreciate them.
How did your education contribute, your formal education, contribute to your awakening? Where I'm leading is you're going to become a diplomat, so yeah. I'm curious as to what are the factors that led you into diplomacy?
Well, I did not want to become a diplomat. that was the last thing on my mind. Actually, what happened was that when I was young, what saved my life was that even though we had no books in the house, obviously, I discovered a little branch of a library about a mile away from my house, and I would go there and read ferociously. I would read novels and books and so on and so forth, whether Tolstoy or Dostoevsky or H.G. Wells or whatever it is. And as a result of this love of reading, actually, when I went to university, and that was also by accident that I ended up in university, because I got a scholarship that paid more than what I would have earned as a textile salesman. That's how I ended up in university. I discovered I love philosophy. Mm-hmm. And I dreamt then, as a young man, that I would spend the rest of my life as a philosopher. But, you know, because of the scholarship I got, I was bonded to the Singapore government for 5 years. So I joined the Foreign Service and worked in the Foreign Service for 5 years, thinking they would be temporary. I ended up staying there 33 years.
Mm-hmm. So now, tell us what it takes to be a diplomat, in both in terms of skills and in terms of temperament.
Mm. Well, there's a very famous British diplomat called Harold Nicholson. He wrote a book just called Diplomacy, and fortunately I happened to read that book very early on in my career. And, you know, most people have the impression that diplomats are devious. As you know, the old adage, diplomats are sent abroad to lie for their country. But when I read his book, I was encouraged because he emphasized the importance of integrity. And he said that a really successful diplomat is someone who speaks as truthfully as possible. By speaking as truthfully as possible, you win the trust of the person you're dealing with. And I've discovered that in diplomacy, winning the trust and confidence of the people that you're dealing with is far more important than trying to lie for short-term gain. And if you can't tell them something, don't lie to them and say, my instructions are not to reveal that. So that's a much more open way of behaving. So I'm in that sense, what you might call an old-fashioned diplomat.
What about temperament? Patience.
I think you have to be patient. When I was ambassador to the UN, representing a small country, I would tell my staff, I said, listen, we are a small country. There's no reason why anybody would want to listen to us when we speak. You only have 3 weapons when you walk into a United Nations room to try and defend your country's interests or to put forward your point of view. And those 3 weapons are reason, logic, and charm. And that's all you have.
So the philosophy paid off in part.
Oh, the philosophy was immensely valuable. I mean, I think my life would have been quite different. I have found that, you know, when I would travel around the world, when I would go to meetings of the non-aligned movement, third world meetings, I found that if you tried to put across your argument in a very clear and logical fashion, especially when you say first, second, third, it would translate very well, because when you speak in the United Nations, everything you say is translated into 5 different languages, 5 mm-hmm. other languages. And if you don't speak clearly and logically, the message gets lost through the process of translation. So I owe a lot to my philosophical training.
Is there an Asian perspective or an Asian wrinkle when it comes to diplomacy that we should talk about?
I think you'll find that with Asians, they are much less direct. And they don't believe, in the case of Asians, face is very important. You know, you got to make sure that when you disagree with someone or when you have to express a different point of view, you try to do it in such a way that he doesn't lose face. Because if he loses face, then he'll be your enemy for the rest of your life. And so it's important to bear that in mind when dealing with Asians. And I think sometimes, of course, Westerners don't realize that, but it's but nowadays, as you know, many Asians are now educated in the West, and they have learned either the good habits or the bad habits of the West, and they're now equally direct and blunt.
What about negotiations, difficult negotiations? We're seeing a lot of very important negotiations going on in Asia now, for example, over North Korea. Are there some lessons that you've learned about reaching agreement in general, negotiating, the way you relate to the other party to accomplish something?
Well, a few lessons that I learned from negotiations is, number one, the personality matters a great deal. And if you have a difficult personality, if you have someone who walks in and says, my demands, my country's interests are such and such, he's not going to succeed. So you have to build up a certain degree of personal rapport, and that's a very important part of the process of negotiations, because each side obviously is going to defend his or her country's national interests, you know. And you don't expect them to sacrifice their national interests, but how you defend the national interests matters a great deal. Secondly, if you want to try and get an agreement, you must always try to get a win-win agreement, because if it's a win-lose agreement, let's say if I get everything that my country wanted and you get nothing that your country wanted, that agreement is not going to last and it won't succeed. And so it's important to find ways and means to ensure that the other party also benefits in the negotiations. I have actually found from personal experience that most diplomats are quite reasonable people and are willing to try to compromise, except, of course, the worst case is if you have a diplomat walking in with a huge ego, and sometimes his ego leads to him sacrificing his country's interests because he wants to have things his own way, even though a compromise would suit his country's interests better than having his ego determine his actions.
Mm-hmm. And is there a qualitative difference, or what sort of a difference is there in representing your country in another country? Say you were ambassador to Cambodia versus being in a multilateral context like the UN. Is it a much tougher job in the UN?
Well, I should for the record say I was chargé d'affaires in Cambodia, not ambassador, but head of mission anyway. Yeah. Bilateral diplomacy is very different from multilateral diplomacy. Mm-hmm. That it is, in fact, it's night and day. Because bilateral diplomacy, you're just dealing with one government and trying to advance your interests, or working with one government and understanding one government. When you go to the United Nations, there are 191 member states, you have to get to know 190 other ambassadors, because the vote of each country counts in the General Assembly. Of course, there are some countries that are more important than other countries. Certainly, you have to get to know the five permanent members, United States, Russia, China, UK, and France. But in general, you have to make an effort to get to know far more countries. So it's a very different ballgame.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk now about your new book, which I will show the audience. It's called Beyond the Age of Innocence, and it's about perceptions of America abroad and how America's role has evolved in the world. Your analysis begins with the post-war period, and you look at what America accomplished, let's say, from the end of World War II to the end of the Cold War. What were the most important features of America's role?
Well, I think America accumulated huge reservoirs of goodwill from the end of World War II to to the end of the Cold War, because America portrayed itself as a country that was concerned not just about its narrow national interests, but also concerned about the larger global interests. And certainly the 1945 multilateral order that America created, and one of the rules of the 1945 multilateral order was that a level playing field was created for all nation states. United States instituted the principle of one country, one vote in the UN General Assembly. Each country felt that it had a right to be independent, to grow, to thrive, to succeed. And as you know, many countries, especially in East Asia, thrived as a result of the 1945 order that America created. And by doing that, America accumulated huge reservoirs of goodwill.
And there are two dimensions that I want to pick out that you point out that strike me as very important to the present now, although the situation is evolving. One is you talk a great deal about the battle of ideas and how much the United States accomplished in its rivalry with the Soviet Union and in its being able to win most of the world because of the ideas it gave to the world. Talk a little about that.
Well, I think the rest of the world could see very clearly that the nature of American society was completely different than the nature of Soviet society. In the Soviet Union, it was command economics, and things happened because of decisions made by a few people at the top, and the system implemented the decisions of a few. In America, you got the sense that the country belonged to the population as a whole, and the population determined the leaders that they should have. And in that open democratic system that America had, people thrived, people could grow, and people could succeed. And the greatness of one of the great things about America, of course, is the great American dream. And this great American dream, as a result of the shrinkage of the world, was shared with the rest of the world. What I say in the book is that America sprinkled magical stardust into the eyes of young people around the world by making them believe that they too could have the American dream for themselves. And by so doing, America changed the grain of human history, you know. Because, let's say, for traditional Asian societies, what you became in your life was determined at birth, you know. Your birth was your destiny. So if you were born in the untouchable caste, you remain in the untouchable caste. If you're born in the Brahmin caste, you belong to the Brahmin caste, and that's where your life will remain forever. This idea of America was that your future was your own. It wasn't determined by where you were born. You could make your own future. And by sharing that idea in a very powerful way with societies all over the world, I think is one reason why societies that have been dormant and unsuccessful for a long time has suddenly begun succeeding and doing well again.
And reflecting now back on your background, as you described it, this is an idea that these are ideas that made an impression on you as an individual too.
Definitely, yeah. Because when I grew up in the 1960s and learned more about America, I also began to subscribe to the belief that I could have a different future than the one that was ordained for me. Because, you know, my great-grandfather, my grandfather, my father were all mainly in this textile business, because that's what all Sindhis, I'm ethnically Sindhi, are supposed to do. And indeed, I still have first cousins and uncles and aunties all doing this textile business. But I, in a sense, benefited from this American idea that you could shape a different future. So I decided I would do something different from what my ancestors had done. And because I could feel the impact of this American dream on my life, I can, in a sense, give personal testimony to the impact of the American dream on the lives of people overseas too.
Another dimension that you talk about in the book in a very positive way is American military power. Now, of course, we built that power to win World War II and then to confront the Soviets. But you're suggesting that something that's often overlooked is the extent to which that military power served a stabilizing function. Talk a little about that.
Oh, the American military in some ways was also a huge gift to the world, mainly because America created belief that you created a stable global environment by creating a set of rules for all countries to follow. But, as you know, whenever you have rules, ultimately you have to have the ultimate guarantor that these rules will be obeyed or implemented.
The police function.
A sort of indirect police function. And the simplest example is, of course, what happens in the case of international waterways through which a lot of trade flows. And some of these waterways are very narrow. So it would be very tempting for states to say, hey, this body of water is mine, and if you want to pass through it, you have to pay a toll, for example. And it would be a natural thing. That's what was done, by the way, in the past. But as a result of the power of the American military, no country even dreams of closing any international waterway, because if they do so, they have to confront the United States Navy. I gave this very unusual example of the Canadians once trying to close the straits north of Canada because they believe it belonged to them. The United States decided it's an international waterway. The U.S. Navy sailed right through it, and the Canadians dropped the argument that this was a domestic waters. So, I mean, in that sense, the American military has been enormously beneficial to the world, without intending to be, by the way. I mean, certainly the Pentagon did not believe they were doing the world a service with this large American military, but it has, in many ways, provided a service. And you could also see, in some ways, the real benefits the American military could bring in the recent Asian tsunami crisis, because when you finally needed to have a massive lift capability to deliver a large amount of humanitarian aid in a very short space of time, the only logistical machines that could deliver that is the American military machine. And of course, Singapore in a small way also played a role, but our military is much smaller, but in some ways also very capable. But it showed the importance of having a strong military capability.
And so the result of all of this, these accomplishments and achievements, some of which were intended, some unintended, you're implicitly arguing that America had a secret weapon, namely the legitimacy of its role in the world.
Oh, yes. In fact, one of the strengths that America had, and I'm glad you introduced the word legitimacy into the discussion, because the rest of the world saw the scale and enormity of American power, but because they believed that this power was being used to advance both American interests and global interests, they were quite happy to recognize this power as being legitimate. And by the way, the critical thing to bear in mind about legitimacy is that legitimacy is in the eyes of the beholder. Mm-hmm. You cannot create it yourself. I mean, America cannot go out and say that its power is legitimate. It's the rest of the world that's got to, in a sense, make that decision. And as you know, for much of the Cold War, in many parts of the world, many people said, this power is legitimate.
Mm-hmm. And legitimacy leads to a situation. If people feel you're legitimate, they can really sense, I would think, whether you're being hypocritical or not, whether you're saying one thing and doing another. So ultimately,
oh, yes,
the two have to go together.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. In fact, as a result, America has probably done more than any other country to educate the rest of the world, because the numbers of foreign students, especially Asian students who study in North American universities now, are hundreds of thousands. Now, having educated these minds and opened their minds, you find that increasingly these minds are using American social science techniques to understand American behavior. And so they can judge American behavior very carefully, very empirically, and say when is American behavior consistent with the values and principles that it espouses, and when is American behavior not consistent with the values and principles it espouses. And if the level of inconsistency becomes higher than the level of consistency, then there's an erosion of the legitimacy of American power, as we have seen.
Mm-hmm. Now, the end of the Cold War comes. Mm. We've won the Cold War. But then American presidents, beginning with the first President Bush, mm. then President Clinton, and then on to President George W. Bush, did something vis-a-vis the world that changed the system that we've been describing drastically. Let's talk a little about that. What did we do after the end of the Cold War that changed, that began the process of changing people's perceptions of the United States?
Well, I think at the end of the Cold War, there was this huge sense of relief in America that it had done its job, that it had carried the world on its shoulders in the battle against the evil Soviet Empire. And after having carried the world on its shoulders for almost 45 years, I think there was a natural inclination in America to say, okay, you've done our job. We have taken care of the world. We've protected the free world. We've defeated the Soviet Empire. Now it's time to come home. And of course, America did not have any intention to harm the world when it was doing it. All it thought was that it was doing, and maybe even doing the right thing in coming home and saying to the world, you could take care of yourself. But having got so involved in the histories of other countries, when America disentangled itself, in the process of disentangling, it left behind pools of turbulence in the world, which unfortunately are now haunting America and haunting the world today.
So a case study of what you're talking about would be the case of Afghanistan. Mm. After we take into account that the U.S. had helped mobilize the global jihad against the Soviet Union and Afghanistan. Talk a little about that.
Yeah, well, Afghanistan, I think, is in some ways the ideal case study to illustrate what happens when America disengages suddenly after having been involved in the country in a big way. As you know, during the Cold War, very senior American figures would go to the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan, stand at the Khyber Pass, carry a Kalashnikov, and say, these are the frontiers of freedom, and we stand here with these freedom fighters, these Islamic freedom fighters, and we are so glad that an Islamic jihad has been launched against the Soviet Union. And so by doing that, America whipped up a sense of solidarity among pools of Muslims that until then had seen very little connection with each other. So you had Mujahideen freedom fighters from Algeria, from Indonesia, from Pakistan, all coming to fight in Afghanistan. But having whipped up this Islamic jihad sentiment, it was basically what America did was to release a genie out of a bottle. And when it left, it didn't try to put the genie back mm-hmm. in the bottle. It left the genie outside the bottle. Mm-hmm. And one of the most controversial things I say or suggest in my book is that if you want to look at the origins of 9/11, for example, what happened on that day, you have to go back and study what happened in Afghanistan in the 1980s, because that's when the genie was let out of the bottle. And in some ways, America let the genie out.
Mm-hmm. And in a way, interesting enough, as we move now into a war on terrorism, which is focused on the Muslim terrorists, who are not at all representative of the broad base of Islam, you are implicitly suggesting that it is not doing a good job anymore in waging a war on the terrain of the battle of ideas. Talk a little about that.
Yeah, well, I think one point I want to emphasize, the point that you just made, is that the vast majority of the 1.2 billion Muslims in the world want to lead normal, peaceful lives. And I think it's important for an American audience not to believe that all these 1.2 billion Muslims are out there trying to either support terrorism or engage in terrorism. That's not true. But it's also true that there's a large amount of anger and antipathy towards America in the Islamic world. And when you have anger and antipathy, normally maybe 1%, 0.5% of that population would try and do something about it. Now, 1% of the Muslim community is 12 million Muslims. Mm-hmm. 0.5% is 6 million Muslims. So you don't want to make such a big number angry towards you. I also say in the book that this antipathy that has arisen between America and the Islamic world was completely unnecessary, because from the 19th century, the early part of the 20th century, no Islamic state was colonized by America. In fact, the Islamic states were colonized by the European powers. And the Islamic states, the Arab states, can remember that it was American decolonization efforts that led to them being decolonization also. So there should have been a naturally happy, constructive, positive relationship between America and the Islamic world. Sadly, the exact opposite has happened. I think it's incumbent upon America, frankly, useful for America from the point of view of its own national self-interest, to go out and understand where these reservoirs of anger have come from. And there is a perception in the Islamic world, and I tell some stories in my book about the attitudes in the mid-1990s, that America seemed to care about human rights when other people's rights were involved. But when Muslim lives were being killed, it didn't seem notice. And of course, as you know, the one case that has more than any other case led to alienation of America is the case of Palestinians, sadly speaking. And that's why it's very important for America to try and do something to revitalize the Middle East peace process again.
You do an excellent job in your book of pointing out that part of the consequence of America's great success in this period after World War II was to start this process in a new way of globalization, to connect the world to the U.S. and vice versa. And what I think you're suggesting in the book is that we are unaware of the extent to which these exchanges and the technology has created a new kind of global Islamic community that may not agree with the terrorists, but is very sensitive to the consequences of American policy on the one hand, and also very sensitive because of Islam's tradition to the injustices that result from that policy.
Yeah, I mean, I think most Americans will be shocked to learn that apart from the conscious efforts that America made to whip up the Islamic jihadist sentiment in Afghanistan, I mean, that was one way in which America changed the Islamic world. But another critical way in which changed the Islamic world was that the different parts of the Islamic world used to live in different pools of history. And there was indeed very little interconnectedness within these different pools of Islamic history. But thanks to the technology that America has created, especially the technology of television and radio and so on and so forth, what America has effectively done is built technological pipes that linked the different pools of Islamic history. And certainly, growing up in Southeast Asia, and in Southeast Asia, by the way, there are more Muslims than there are in the Arab world, there was very little consciousness, for example, of Palestine or the struggle of Palestine in the 50s or 60s or even the 70s. But in the 80s and 90s, as you got more and more households getting television, as more and more Muslims in Southeast Asia were getting daily scenes of Palestinians being killed, the sense of solidarity within different parts of the Islamic world grew significantly. And today, with Al Jazeera being shown on a daily basis, on a Malay dubbing basis in Southeast Asia, it aggravates the problem even more. So I think it's important for America to be aware both of the intended consequences of his actions and the unintended consequences of his actions, because quite often the unintended consequences are much larger and much bigger than the Americans are aware of.
And this was true in the economic realm in the 90s when the Asian financial crisis came, and the American response was not what it might have been with global interests having the priority because of the Cold War, that they were now that the Cold War was over. Talk a little about that, because many Asian countries were really disappointed by our response.
I think even though I mentioned in my book that the turning point in America's relations with the world happened at the end of the Cold War, it took some time for other countries to realize that America's attitudes towards them had changed. And as you know, what I talk about in the book is how America behaved when the Asian financial crisis happened. And when the Asian financial crisis happened, many of the long-standing allies of the United States in Southeast Asia, take for example Thailand and Indonesia, assumed that because they had been long-standing allies of the United States, United States would in one way or another, directly or indirectly, come to their rescue. And it came as a shock, I think, to both the Thai and Indonesian elites when they realized that they were no longer necessary allies, that they had become dispensable. And I quote a senior Treasury official as saying when he was asked, would America rescue Thailand in the way they rescued Mexico from the Asian financial crisis? The response of this Treasury official was, well, Thailand is not at our border, is it? Mm-hmm. So why should we? I mean, this idea that America would only care about the countries on its border went against the whole spirit of what America projected to the rest of the world throughout the Cold War, when in its rhetoric, daily rhetoric, America would always say that America was not out there in the world protecting just American interests, it was also protecting global interests. And you know the famous words of President John F. Kennedy, "We will pay any price, bear any burden to go out and defend liberty." In all through its words and deeds in the Cold War, it seemed to suggest that America was not just about American interests, America was also about the global interests. But event after event, the 1990s began to reveal that the global interests began to matter less and less to America, and that's how the process of disillusionment began to rise with America.
So that, for example, the response of the Clinton administration to aspects of the global crisis, in the case of a neighboring state like Mexico, they were willing to intervene to stabilize the situation. In the case of an American hedge fund that was about to lose a lot of money, it was willing to intervene. But in the case of Indonesia and Thailand, it didn't find the need. And in fact, when push comes to shove, you're suggesting in your book, they would intervene to protect American business in Indonesia, but not necessarily the stability of Indonesian money.
See, the big difference, if I had to summarize it very crudely, in terms of American approaches, let's say to the Mexican financial crisis and to the crisis involving long-term capital management, is that America was very concerned about the consequences of the policies that he recommended. If there was a breakdown in Mexico or if there's a breakdown in America, he would try to avoid it and focus on minimizing the consequences. In the case of Thailand and Indonesia, it took a very clinical approach and said, you have to carry out these policies. And even though in some cases, as you know, the policies resulted in social unrest, they say, well, that's your problem. That's not our problem. And that sent an incredibly negative signal to these populations, which had hitherto believed that America would not do things that would damage them. And as I mentioned in the book, that at one stage during the Asian financial crisis, there was an effort by Japan to set up an Asian rescue effort to rescue some of these countries. And America essentially vetoed that move and said, no, you are disrupting the rules of the game. There should just be an international reaction and no regional reaction. So on the one hand, America was perceived to be not mobilizing the international institutions to help Thailand and Indonesia effectively. On the other hand, it also blocked Japan from mounting a sort of Asian regional effort. And, you know, that it does lead to questions in people's minds and saying, but I thought these Americans cared about other people. I thought they cared about their friends. I thought they would come to help their friends in the need. Why? Where are they now? And that, as I said, began to change color the attitudes of the rest of the world.
You bring your analysis to what I guess we must agree is the most important international issue in the coming century, namely the world's relationship with China. Mm. And you're suggesting that America, in a way, is innocent, I guess in a positive sense, but to the point of being disruptive when it sees China as an emerging power that must be contained in the way that the Soviet Union was contained.
Yeah, I think the most Americans believe that America is not out to threaten or to subvert China. And I think clearly most Americans have no desire whatsoever. In fact, many of them are celebrating and are happy with the success of China. If American intentions towards China are benign, then clearly the Chinese should develop a positive attitude towards America. But as I document in the book, the trend line in China, as you know, sadly, has been negative. And I demonstrate this with one simple case study, the case study of the American bombing of the Chinese embassy in Belgrade. Every American that I've spoken to, including senior policymakers, keep telling me, Kishore, obviously it was an accident. We didn't intend to bomb the Chinese embassy. Why would we want to do so, you know? But when I speak to the Chinese policymakers tell me that and including the Chinese policymakers, Chinese mid-levels, lower levels, excuse me, they're all convinced that this bombing was deliberate and a signal by America to China, beware of American power. Now that's something that shows a reservoir of suspicion in China towards America.
And many American presidents have been have begun in a truly naive way, trying to impose democratization on China, which I guess fits into this. A corruption of the power of American ideas that was such an ideal in an earlier period.
Well, I think the point to remember about the whole democracy debate is that all countries in the world eventually will have to become democratic if they're to succeed, because only if you have a kind of open democratic society will you allow your people to participate fully in the country's development. So the destination is not in doubt. The only question is how quickly can you get to the destination? And in many American minds, there's this belief that you can take any society, flip a switch, and it can go immediately from authoritarian rule to democratic rule. But history teaches us it cannot be done. Certainly the case of Russia demonstrates that if you flip the switch, when you go from authoritarian rule to democratic rule, the society can suffer. And as you know, there was an implosion of living standards in Russia in the 1990s because of this sudden switch. So the lesson that China learned from this exercise is that, yes, we eventually have to get democratic, but we have to do it slowly, gradually, at our pace, and after we have built up a strong enough middle class and a strong enough society in China. So they find these American pressures on China to say, hey, you got to change immediately, not as a benign intention on the part of America, but rather they perceive this as an effort by America to trip up China's development and to in some ways maybe replicate the kind of problems and chaos that Russia experienced in the 1990s. And they're obviously not going to welcome that for their society.
I to summarize, I guess you're saying in your book that you would like to help American understand their failing in understanding the consequences of their action.
Hmm.
That seems to be very important.
I think my message is actually a larger one.
Yeah.
That my larger message is that America has done more than any other society to change the world. And by the way, often change the world positively. But paradoxically, having changed the world, America is one of the countries least prepared to handle the world it has changed. Mm. I mean, to quote a few obvious examples, America has educated the world. You have these hundreds of thousands of graduates from North American universities making decisions, making policies, and assessing American attitudes and American policies towards them. And they can see the double standards. They can see that America carries out actions that harm or damage them, and a complete indifference of American society when their societies are damaged. I'll give the obvious example of how when America decides to have cotton subsidies for 25,000 cotton farmers in the South, this lowers the world's global cotton prices and impoverishes 10 million West African cotton farmers. Now, most Americans will say, well, we're just making a domestic decision. We had no intention whatsoever to harm the 10 million West African cotton farmers. But now, in an open and transparent global information universe, you can see in real time what happens. And I quote, by the way, in the book, the series of New York Times editorials that were written documenting how American subsidies are impoverishing people elsewhere. The rest of the world sees this process happening, but they find a complete indifference of American society to the effects of their actions. And people are saying, hang on a second, this is not what I learned in America. I learned in America that the American society was open, warm, and generous, and cares for the rest of the world. And indeed, once, as you know, recently in the Asian tsunami crisis, America once again showed the incredible generosity of spirit that exists in American society. And that's the image you had throughout the world. That's the image that Americans have of themselves vis-a-vis the rest of the world. But that image is being cracked because of the perception that when America carries out actions that damage the rest of the world, it's indifferent to the consequences of its actions.
It sounds like you're saying, to paraphrase you, that America power has globalized the world and created connections both economically in terms of information, culturally, and so on the one hand. Mm. But on the other hand, America has not adjusted to global politics. Mm. To quote Tip O'Neill, all politics is local. And that seems to be the heart of the dilemma that you're getting at. So that in other words, with regard to policies to the Middle East, it may be domestic constituencies that are overly determining the direction of American policy, which doesn't take account of the broader global interests. The same probably would be true on agriculture and so on. Mm. Is that fair?
Yes. I think the it's a pity that Americans are not aware of now how heavily American power sits on the rest of the world. And I give the use analogy of a car that is parked on your toes, you know. American power is like a car parked on your toes. And people in the car in America are not aware that this car is parked on other people's toes. But those whose toes the car is parked on are acutely aware of how American power sits on them. So I hope that one of the results of my book will be a more open discussion within American society about the impact of American power on the rest of the world, because the impact is real and not theoretical. But I'm glad you mentioned Tip O'Neill and his point that all politics is local. That's true. But the big change now is that global is now local. Mm-hmm. That things that happen, what you thought was happening far away, is now going to affect you immediately. And so far, given the scale of American power, most of the time, America impacts on the rest of the world. The rest of the world doesn't impact on America. But you can see the beginnings already of how in a small world decisions made overseas can impact American society directly. This was, in a sense, the big lesson of 9/11. It showed that when you abandon a society like Afghanistan in 1990, you feel the consequences of it in 2001. Another immediate example that you can think of is, of course, what in health pandemics nowadays, they no longer stay in one location. You look at the SARS crisis, SARS virus. It began in a small village in China. From China, it went to Hong Kong. And from Hong Kong, it went almost immediately to Singapore and Toronto, to two opposite sides of the world. And that demonstrates how much the world has shrunk. I mean, America escaped SARS by a whisker, but it's going to come. It's going to happen. That what happens in the rest of the world is going to impact on American society. And because it is going to impact on American society, it is in America's enlightened, long-term self-interest to go out and create a more stable world order, as it did in 1945, by the way, because a stable world order will not just protect global interests, it also protect long-term American national interests.
And another place where this may, you're looking into the future may come true is with regard to the fall of the dollar. Because by not being accountable globally, we're pointing the way to our vulnerability in the future.
Yes, I think the remarkable thing here is that this single global financial system that we have, which, as you know, enables money to flow instantly across the world, was essentially an American creation. And it showed, and as a result of this financial system that you have, the value of the dollar can no longer be determined by domestic decisions. Mm-hmm. It will be determined by global forces. So far, fortunately, thanks to the large savings that Asian countries have, they, as you know, they've been buying the U.S. Treasury bills at very low interest rates, and that has enabled America in some ways to continue with the huge deficits it's having. But at some point in time, if you don't balance your books, it catches up with you. No country can defy the laws of economic gravity. And so America, too, at some point will have to find some ways of cutting down its budget deficits. And if it doesn't, then I think, sadly, both America will feel the pain. And because America feels the pain, the rest of the world will feel America's pain, too.
One final question. Your great store of wisdom coming from your diplomatic career with your new role as dean of the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy in Singapore, to ask you, what advice would you give students as they prepare for the future?
Well, the advice is actually very simple. The Asian century is not a myth. The Asian century is here and now. You know, one of the most amazing statistics that I found recently is that if you look at the top 10 countries sending students to America, they're primarily all Asian countries. If you look at the top 10 countries that American students go to study abroad, they're all in Europe. Mm. And obviously, it seems very strange in the 21st century when clearly by the year 2025, in purchasing power parity terms, China will probably have the world's largest economy, America will have the second largest economy, India will have the third, Japan will have the fourth, and then you'll have South Korea and so on and so forth. At a time when the Asian economies are growing and will have a larger share of the global economic pie, and the European share will remain the same, hopefully, why would you want to send your brightest minds? I mean, you should certainly send some to Europe, but don't you think there should be an equal number or maybe a bigger number that go and study in Asia too? So I have told my children, for example, that they have to study English and they should also know Mandarin because that would be an important language of the 21st century. And also, Hindi will also be very important because of the rise of India. But statistically, and I think I have the statistic in my book, there are 1 million American students studying French and 40,000 studying Chinese.
Oh dear.
And French is an important language, I don't deny it, but there should be at least some parity between Mandarin and French in the 21st century.
Dean Mahbubani, thank you very much for taking time to come and be with us today to share your intellectual odyssey, and finally to share with us the friendly advice you have for America as it views the world. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.